Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, I can't quit you, babe. But I got to put you down for a while. Well, you know I can't quit you, babe.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio. I'm Patrick Connor of Knuckles and Gloves, the Fight City, as you saw recently, occasionally Bad Left Hook, sometimes some other places. And also joining me today, as always, my buddy, author, filmmaker, Bryn Jonathan Butler, and all-around good guy, I should mention. How's it going, man?
It's going good. Unfortunately, Kim is not going to be able to make it this week, so your introduction was not deceitful. But it was incorrect.
That's all right. We'll get our comrade here, Kim Francesca, was going to join us this week, but we'll get her on another week. She's a very astute mind in the boxing media field. Also, just a really nice person. She'll be on, I'm sure, at some point. But
she'll be. But I'm going to bring the estrogen today. Like, listeners have never had it before.
Thank goodness. We've been missing.
Yeah.
I should also just point out, just I guess to be fair, because it was pointed out to me recently, that just in case anybody is tuning in for the first time or one of the first times or something like that and they're unaware, every so often we might drop an F-bomb in there. We might say, you know, a bit of a MF, some other stuff. So just, you know, for all the baby-eared people out there, all the people who are sensitive, or perhaps if you have kids within earshot, just beware. But now that that's over, we got boxing to talk about, people, and boxing sometimes gets violent, gets vulgar, gets a little crazy. This weekend on HBO, that's what we're hoping for, violent, vulgar, crazy, super flyweight division. The card is called Superfly on HBO, and it's featuring a rematch between Sri Saket, Sorum Rungvise, Roman Chocolatito Gonzalez, and then on the undercard, it's got two fights between other super flyweights, Carlos Cuadras and Juan Francisco Estrada, and then also Japanese fighter, monster, Naoya Inoue, and also Antonio Nieves. Wow, there's just a bunch of mouthfuls there, but they're all pint-sized. Yeah, so that's my contribution. All right, guys, see you later.
Thanks, Patrick. Now, I'd like to talk about some estrogen-related issues with boxing, which has traditionally been
Perfect.
A fairly misogynistic... No, it's not going to happen.
Or we can just make this political, like we do every week. But, you know, it's... I just have to say, I actually was hoping to get Kim's take on the whole... basically, the entrance of... especially Inoue into the American TV scene, basically, but also just in general, the kind of development over the last year or two, maybe a little bit more of basically the bosses and the honchos at American networks being more keen on featuring smaller fighters on fight cards where, I mean, it's just historically not a thing. It's not something that U.S. networks are keen on doing in general. And it seems that Roman Gonzalez was really the key, at least for many people, to kind of unlocking that door, to breaking that barrier down for whatever reason it was there in the first place. It shouldn't have been, because these lighter weight fighters often produce really great fights. But what's your take on this? How do you feel about the entrance of the... especially, I mean, this card, it's an international fight card. It's got fighters from Mexico, Nicaragua, Japan, Thailand, the U.S., and that's just the three main fights. There's also Brian Valoria, Hawaiian. You know, I mean, it the list goes on. So what's your take on this?
Well, I just think it's just reflecting the audience that boxing has. I mean, I think there was a lot of people talk about how MMA has hugely attracted a predominantly white audience, but boxing has trended much more towards especially a Latino audience, but what Pacquiao was able to do to gain massive international appreciation and esteem and excitement all over Asia, and I mean anywhere in the world, people know Manny Pacquiao. That's a big deal. I mean, kind of like that Bruce Lee effect in film, where for the first time there was an Asian American who wasn't conforming to a stereotype, who was powerful and charismatic and allowed to be an individual. I think you're seeing boxing. I don't think it's anything to do with boxing's promoters, you know, wanting to broaden the scope of the audience because of some altruistic motive. I think it's just that's the audience that still loves boxing. That's more and more the one they have to cater to get the dollars. And I love it. I mean, I love going to fights where you're seeing countries in a big way represented and passionate fans that are, you know, in many cases flying out to see fights. So I really enjoy that dynamic, and it doesn't, I generally haven't felt like there's antagonism between the countries. It's just like soccer, that kind of fervor about fighting for something more than just your own individual narrative, but the narrative of your country and making people proud. So I really enjoy it.
Yeah, I don't want to be like a sourpuss or anything either, and I don't want to, you know, talk down the motives behind it or anything, but that's the truth, and that's always been the truth, that the popular, like the money follows where the popularity is in boxing, basically. And, you know, just as a number of different promoters have kind of exploited or, I mean, again, I don't want to say exploit because I think that kind of gives it a negative connotation, and that's not always the case. But they have kind of exploited certain markets, and the Mexican market in particular has been really played upon in the last handful of years because it's had to have been. I mean, that's where the money is. That is where the money has followed the most popular the most popular fighter in the world, who's Mexican. So, well, I mean, I guess that's not fully true given what we were talking about last weekend, but the most popular active serious fighter in the world. How about that? But nonetheless, I think that it's not necessarily a bad thing that those markets are being, you know, tapped into. And especially in this case, where recently Top Rank had kind of tried to make a foray into the Chinese market and are, kind of still are, but to a lesser extent, especially now that Zhao Ximing is, you know, not really panned out how they expected or how they wanted. But the point is that the door was opened. And now that it is open, and I mean, it kind of always has been open. It just has been perceived as closed for many years, especially to, you know, just to these lower weight classes. And now that it's a little more free flowing, hopefully we're just seeing better fights.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, and I think it's really good for Americans to see examples of fighters that don't conform to sort of traditional Hollywood stereotypes about where those places are from. I mean, like the Borat phenomena of exploiting American ignorance to what the hell is going on in Kazakhstan. Where is it again? Is it Kazakhstan?
Yeah, it's Kazakhstan.
Yeah. So Kazakhstan. So coming up with a national anthem that I think was played, the Borat anthem, for Kazakhstani athletes who were performing, and they're looking around like, what? And, you know, because we just have no idea what it represents, that we were like, it must be that this guy's racist against Kazakhstan. And it's like, no, what he's making a play off of is the fact that we don't know what the hell it could be, so he can make up whatever he wants. So when you see come from Kazakhstan who doesn't fit any kind of, you know, Rocky IV narrative of what it would be like to be from the former Soviet Union, I think that's just great because it does open your eyes to, like, maybe I want to learn more about this. Maybe I want to get more informed about it. Maybe there's something appealing about these differences that I can sort of tap into. And you see the same thing with people essentially being not emblematic, but like emissaries from a different culture that can really turn you on. I mean, it's what happened for me with Cuban boxers is I was just like, why am I only seeing them on the international stage, but not in pro boxing. That's such an interesting dynamic. I had to know more about it. And all of these places have, you know, the boxers can function as skeleton keys into the culture, where you want to open a lot more doors into what they're about. And it makes it more interesting. It makes it more rich, and you get better combinations with the fighters when you know their backstory more. So it makes it easier to kind of hold your hand with an individual story into the bigger story that's behind them with the country that they come from. Just like with Pacquiao, you know, like that lead up to Pacquiao Mayweather. I love, you know, only boxing could turn a man into a miracle was that entry narrative to it's happening. And it's amazing that a guy was selling donuts on the side of the road and is able to be the kind of athlete he is. Guy who's 5'5" and 145 pounds. What other major sport is he going to do it in? You know, it's boxing, soccer. So it's a fun thing to get behind that there's still that transformative effect that something like boxing can have for these guys. And I get, and represent something much bigger than they are is just a fun thing to experience when you go to fights. I mean, going to a Golovkin fight, I was like, I'm not aware that I bumped into many Kazakhstani citizens, and there were hundreds of them for a fight early on in his career when he came to New York, and it was like, I've never seen such passionate people. So it was a fun thing to see that.
And it is kind of nice, especially given that we can get a little, well, I mean, I'll speak for myself, we can get a little cynical on the show and a little bit you know, focused on some of the things that are negative or some of the things that are bad about boxing. And that's important because there should be people who call that type of stuff out. But that being said, it's nice to also recognize that there's positive things about the sport still, like, for instance, that it's still a sport that can pull somebody from the gutter, that it's still a sport that speaks to many different kinds of people. You know, like that's important. That's important to have that recognized too, because it can get cynical down in these fucking trenches, man.
Absolutely. And we see, like we did with Pacquiao, that what he's drawing from with the culture that was very foreign, I think, to your average American boxing fan, you know, what did they know about the Philippines? What did they know what it represents? That whatever it did represent to Pacquiao was drawing such enthusiasm. He had such a different demeanor going into fights. He wasn't trying to play the tough guy. He wasn't sullen. He wasn't angry. He was beloved, and he seemed even more in love with the people who were supporting him, and they were so enthused to represent something, you know, this guy who seemed just so charged and so thrilled to be representing them. That kind of passion, it doesn't threaten our own patriotism. It's just, it makes us appreciate other cultures in a way that's not glib or cheap or, I think, manipulative. Like, it, you didn't need to package it. It was right there. You could see it on his face, and you could see it in the face of the people representing him. And as you say, like, it wasn't just him who emerged from the gutter. The people who were walking into the ring with him, Boo Boy and those kind of people, like, they knew him since they were little kids, and here they are on the world stage. That was, it's fun to see those kind of people get there as well. I mean, and yes, there is a whole drawback of what happens to them after the career is over. But in the meantime, they are living a dream, and seeing some people live that is really, you know, it's kind of emotional to see it, because they're very appreciative of it. They know where they came from.
Do you feel like Manny Pacquiao's rise to fame and the fact that he became such a recognized name, especially in the U.S., where, you know, I mean, it's basically still perceived where if you're going to be successful in boxing, it has to be in the U.S. I mean, that's not true, but that's the perception for a lot of people still. And
yeah,
Manny Pacquiao was able to, you know, Manny Pacquiao was able to become a household name in the U.S. Do you think that was a natural step, you know, in the progression of all this?
Perception, I mean, even if it's other English-speaking countries, you're still – I remember a friend of mine said that the funniest encounter he ever had with a celebrity was working in some professional capacity as a photographer, and Robbie Williams, the pop star from, I think, the late 90s or early 2000s, a massive star in the United Kingdom, came to the U.S. and he was in L.A. doing some promotional stuff. Nobody knew who he was. Like, he just couldn't break in the U.S. and he was signing contract deals for like close to $100 million for 5 albums, way bigger than 99.9% of like major artists in the U.S. But he had no traction whatsoever, really, outside of the UK and maybe some other foreign markets. And he just found it amazing to be there in LA, and nobody knew who he was. Wherever he went, it didn't mean anything. And if he was in the UK, he would be mobbed. And I remember having lunch with Amir Khan and Freddie Roach when they were sort of stranded in Vancouver. Nobody had a clue who Amir Khan was, and yet, sort of in the semi-early days of social media, he had 1 million people on Facebook following him and huge Twitter following, massive name in the UK. Nobody had a clue who he was in Canada, really. And he was charmed by it. He wasn't, but it was sort of a heady experience just because he's like, I haven't been able to live like a normal person in a while. Like, once I went to the Olympics and won the silver medal, like, I was a celebrity. Everywhere I went, I had to be sort of protected from people. And here I am with kind of a very big star in the U.S. also with Freddie Roach, with the reality show and Pacquiao and all that. This is like 2010, I think. But, you know, I could walk down a major street in Vancouver. Nobody would even ask him for an autograph. None of the waiters knew who he was, nothing like that. So I think it's great. I really enjoy when guys are able to sort of get to those next levels with boxing by what they're showing us in the ring. You know, that there's just something bigger than two guys beating the shit out of each other, but that narrative that makes you ask questions and want to learn more about them. And boxing is a wonderful tool for that.
There's no question. And I think that the main event of this HBO card, it's a rematch of a fight that illustrates exactly that. And especially because, you know, Roman Gonzalez, at the time undefeated at 46-0, the question was, you know, can he get to the kind of 50-0 mark that everybody's ranting and raving about with Floyd Mayweather now? Could he get to that mark? And could he get to that mark having faced, you know, what many people felt was more difficult opposition, or doing it in a more difficult way? And with Roman Gonzalez, he was exciting because of the way that he carried on his business, basically. And that he was exciting because he beat the shit out of people with style, basically. But in his last handful of fights, as he rose up in weight, I think that his early days at flyweight, which really wasn't all that long ago, but even so, and we kind of spoke about this recently, at only 30 years old, Roman Gonzalez is old for a smaller fighter. And yep. Even so, his, you know, earlier days at lightweight, and even just what, 2013, I would say, basically at that time, he then seemed to kind of become slowly less effective. And then after leaving flyweight, after defeating Akira Yagashi and then Rocky Fuentes, and then leaving flyweight, I think that he has just seemed a bit less effective, moved not quite as good, etc., and had to, for instance, kind of pull the win against Carlos Cuadras out of his ass a little bit. It was a difficult fight. He got busted up. And then this first fight against Sorungvisse was a really difficult fight for him. It was a fight that I felt that he won fairly narrowly, but Sorungvisse was able to just basically give him a whole lot of trouble by moving his hands. He didn't really do a ton that was really complicated. He didn't really trick him or anything like that. He did have a very awkward style, but at the same time, it's not like it was anything that was profound. Pretty much Sorungvisse was like strong arming his way in, and the stuff that was usually hurting guys at flyweight with a punch or two from Gonzalez wasn't hurting Sorungvisse, and that was a huge difference. That doesn't mean he deserved to win, but that's why we're having a rematch.
Yeah. And I mean, that's part of the drama with all of this is the calibration of seeing somebody who looks unbeatable. They're never going to be that guy again the next day. They're going to be something a little bit different. You know, they're like these expensive bottles of wine. They're living things. They're changing all the while. They're never static. They're one punch away and sparring away from getting a hand injury, which totally changes the trajectory of their career irrevocably, where they become somebody different. You know, Floyd was a very different fighter before he had hand issues. He was not really boring in, you know, fighting Corrales and those kind of people. We don't appreciate those differences. They become sort of trivial points where we're like, oh, yeah, he's got hand injury. But it's very, very real to them if you have those problems. You know, if you're a runner and you develop heel problems, you can't run in a serious way. If you were a basketball player and you have an Achilles tendon that gets damaged, you're never going to be able to jump the same way. So we forget that as these guys are moving up in weight, what they're doing between fights. That fight was very interesting to watch with Chuck Liddell because, as you say, stuff where you're just like, how can anybody stand in front of him? Somebody you'd never heard of was quite easily standing in front of him, just eating all those punches, coming forward, and Chuck Liddell at a new weight class has to learn to fight a different way or he's just going to have wars against people that are not necessarily the top people in the division. So what is he supposed to do at 30 years old? It's going to be a lot more difficult to move down a weight class where his power can be more effective. But these little guys, I mean, as you say, by 30 years old, they are reliant on things that have gotten them to where they are that they're going to lose very, very quickly. They're going to lose a step. They're going to lose foot speed. They're going to lose coordination. They're not going to be able to measure people the same way. So it's an interesting – it makes it a lot more dramatic compared to what you see with heavyweights where George Foreman, you know, if he can hit you, he'll drop you. But basically everything else, you know what you're getting because it's been pretty much the same since he got out of the Olympics. You know, he didn't really change that much. These little guys – they're just so much more complex, their arsenal and what the dynamics are that are involved in beating guys. It's so much more technical that I hope that this is able to help educate fans to appreciate just how good they are because they're so special to get to this level. It's so much more reliant on coaching and developing their skills and smarts. You know, you can see their intelligence about how calculating they are to do what they're able to do. It's not just big, strong guys who hit you once cleanly and you're down. They really have to earn their victories. They have to earn their supremacy in a very different way than the bigger guys have to.
I guess if there's anybody who I would, I guess, kind of trust to be able to come back from a loss, and it wasn't a devastating loss. It was just it was a crappy loss, and it was a loss that a lot of people didn't even agree with in the first place. But nonetheless, it's a loss, and it goes down on his ledger as a loss. And he didn't take it like a jerk either. He just kind of was like, well, you know, I lost. And I think that even just having that attitude was something. It's something honorable. It's something to respect. But if there's anybody who's able to come back from that kind of loss, and anybody who's able to, even at 30 years old, which might be old for a younger fighter, figure out how to fight differently or better, I think that it could be Roman Gonzalez. Because you could see even in the Sorungvisay fight, the first one, that as the fight wore on, I mean, Gonzalez hit the deck in the first round. And it was almost like when he hit the deck, when he was knocked down, he wasn't super badly hurt. But it was clear that when he got up, he was almost kind of like surprised, like, oh, that can happen. That's a thing.
Yeah.
All right. And then as the fight wore on, though, the look on his face changed, and he became aware that, oh shit, like this is a dire situation. This is not just me kind of having a little bit of difficulty putting this guy away. Like this guy is pushing back and this is right. Kind of difficult. And you could just see that things were kind of, you know, the cogs were turning, the wheels were working. And I think that kind of gives me hope that this fighter, perhaps he is the special fighter that we thought he was, and that the loss doesn't really mean that much. And hopefully that's something that we can kind of get back to remembering in the boxing world, that the losses don't, you know, that's not everything. Nonetheless, I think this rematch is important for that reason.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think we have to remember when we look at great fighters, what makes Muhammad Ali so extraordinary is that we have the first version of him where he's just this surreal, untouchable talent, like just athletic specimen that's so beyond the pale. And then he comes back from the exodus, you know, during the Vietnam struggle that he had, and he's a different fighter. He's a totally different fighter. We had no idea really of the kind of chin that he had, you know, that what he could do against, you know, just the most epic era of heavyweights that there's ever been, the kind of punches he'd take, the kind of metal he had, the kind of determination he had. You know, we really had him in one box with his early career, and he became something so different in the second half of his career. We had him for 21 years. So there's so many different chapters in that career that give us the finished product of how he created the esteem that he was able to engender. And I think the same thing is true with other great fighters. Roy Jones Jr. now cannot just be the untouchable phenom. We saw what it was like, how he gutted out that first close fight with Tarver. And then once Tarver really closes in and lands the big shot, Jones now forever, when you hold up his career into the light, you know, what was he without that phenomenal athleticism? He didn't have the greatest chin. So when we put him in against historical greats, we have to look at him a little differently. And it's true with any great fighter, is that once they slow down, if they're not able to make adjustments, we're not able to put them into that Ali category, because we have certain baselines with real historical greats who we know now, with their career finished, they're in the canon as people who were able to make adjustments and stay great, but stay great in different ways and add complexity. As they became more limited, they had to fight smarter. And some fighters weren't ever able to make that adjustment. Roy Jones, you know, the second half of his career, where he's now fighting for what? Fucking 25 years. There's your F-bomb. Fucking. 25 years for 10, 15 years, totally untouchable. And then at the end, anything that touches him, pretty much he's going down. He just can't take those shots any longer. So you can't put that genie back into the bottle. It's just part of what the story is of how we're going to evaluate him. And it doesn't diminish how great he was at his peak, but when they're not at their peak is also an important aspect of their respective legacy. And so, you know, I think Chocolatito, you're absolutely right. He's going to have to change at 30. He's not going to be the same fighter he was at a lower weight class when he was in his athletic prime. Now we get to see what else he can do. And in some ways, like Ali, you could argue that he could become greater in terms of how fans are able to appreciate him if he's going to make some adjustments that are going to make him more dominant. But does he have the recognition that those adjustments have to be made? He was in that fight, as you say. He was put down. It's definitely a humbling moment. He made some adjustments. But going forward, is the people in his corner cognizant of that, and are they going to try to recalibrate him into something a little different than we've seen? Is he going to continue to learn? We don't know. You know, some of these guys coast and get an artificial sense of where they're at, where the competition's at, and that's what puts them into real danger. Duran was a very different fighter after he left lightweight, you know, where he's arguably the most dominant lightweight of all time. Very different when he's fighting bigger boys, and I think that's what generated, you know, how beloved he was when he's fighting everybody that's there. Then you have other people, you know, Floyd being very picky about who he was fighting, smart business, but it makes it harder to think, you know, how would he have done fighting, you know, the kings of the welterweights in the 1980s, you know, how would he have done against the Tommy Hearns? Would he have even fought Hearns, because it would just be too much of a risk? Something Roy Jones told me when I asked him about fighting all those guys, the only one he was very open about saying, no, I would have had trouble with him, was Hearns. Sparred with Leonard when I was a kid. I was I was talking to him after a round or two, like it wasn't that hard. Turns would be a little more difficult. So that's fun for us who like to toss around these hypotheticals to imagine what would have happened. And I mean, Chocolatito definitely has that magic dust on him when you watch him. You know you're watching something special, but now he's 30. It's kind of amazing that he's already 30 with so many fights under his belt. But I'm very interested to see where he goes and definitely hold him in that esteem that he is something very special.
Well, that's being a huge Tommy Hearns fan, that's music to my ears, of course, just because that's Tommy Hearns. But come on, let's just be real here. He would have given just about anybody in history a serious pain in the ass time just because it's Tommy Hearns.
Oh.
Again, I'm biased. Still, I think that that air of invincibility, it is important. At least these days, in this era, it's far more important. And I don't want to say you can thank Floyd Mayweather for that, because it's not like he invented the idea of capitalizing off of being undefeated. But I think that with so much money and so much at stake for him tied to being undefeated and having that mystique, I think that he has placed a different value on being undefeated. And not just him. I mean, it's a number of different factors. It's the fact that TV dates are not always easy to come by unless you play the right kind of ball. It's the fact that there are fewer outlets willing to cover boxing serious. I mean, I could go on for days, and you know, we've talked about this many different times, but all of these factors kind of converge and mean that undefeated mystique is more important than perhaps it should be. And with Roman Gonzalez losing in that first fight, it does kind of make me think, and we were also talking about this part recently, where we were wondering about HBO's what their intentions are going forward with boxing and what they're going to invest in going forward in boxing given their year in 2017. And at the lower weights, it seemed as though Roman Gonzalez was their guy. That was the guy that, okay, hey, you want us to get involved in these lower weight classes? Fine, we'll do that. But we're going to stick with this guy, so he better be good. And he goes and loses. Again, I don't think that it was a loss that was deserved, but nonetheless, he lost. And so that does kind of make me wonder what HBO's thoughts are in this whole thing. Like, do they feel like it's worth the bother? You know, do they feel like they would just be better off investing money from lightweight up and that's it? You know, it's just kind of, it does kind of make me wonder what is going to happen. But regardless of all of that, we do have a card where six fighters are being featured at this weight class on Saturday. And another fight on the card that I think has the ability to be well, they all do in my opinion, but especially Carlos Cuadras and Juan Francisco Estrada. They're two guys who are, you know, they throw a lot of punches, they come forward, they don't like to give a whole lot of ground unless they have to, but they're also both skilled and they can both counterpunch fairly well. And so I think that this could be a pretty high-paced, high-skill type of fight going in there. I mean, are you familiar with either guy all that much beyond of what, you know, what's been put on HBO or the major networks?
Just that. But I mean, I'm pumped on all these fights. As you say, they're all elite level fighters and these are dangerous fights for all of them. So I heard actually from a lot of people that I didn't assume would be like, I'm really pumped to see this fight. Like, where are we going to watch this fight? And that's not common for like a non-major event that attracts like casual fans. Like it's definitely getting attention. So I think they're clever with this, but I certainly agree with you. I think with Arum creating this deal with ESPN, which is going to basically cut off him dealing with HBO, HBO is in a really weird spot going forward, you know, where they don't really have a major promoter sending them fighters. So, and they don't have Anthony Joshua either, who just signed a fight that's coming up in October that I'm aware of. I don't think they signed Joshua for any kind of deal. So they're in a very unusual spot in that, you know, other than some major events that they can put on, you're not going to see that kind of farm system of HBO at night or just regular sort of fights that sort of put fighters in front of you to help us get educated about what they're about and how good they are and what the appetite of fans. So I'm curious where they go from here in a lot of ways.
It does make me wonder. I mean, and it does kind of make me also wonder if they're looking to find something on this card. There's a lot of kind of shifting going. It's a joke that I always, you know, make, but I always say, oh, there's a lot of moving parts and there's a lot of shifts and shit like that, because that's just the kind of thing that when people don't know what to say, that's their answer. There's a lot of moving parts. Like, that's true, though, in this case, and in the case of, you know, boxing promotion and how all of this stuff is going, is there are a lot of moving parts, and it almost seems like from day to day, you never really know who's going to be able to work with who.
No, you're absolutely right. And it's very frustrating that Arum signs a deal with ESPN and we're supposed to be like, oh, great, that boxing's back on TV. But what we need to have is that multiple promoters are signing with ESPN so that we're going to get the best fights
right.
that boxing can produce, like any other major league where the best is sort of obliged to fight the best rather than just a continuation of what we've seen for the last 15, 20 years where it's just every fight is an example. The biggest fights that boxing offers generally are the ones it's not able to put on at the right time. So you're always aware, okay, we get this, but we should be getting that. And that's not a good look for the sport. Like, it needs to do something about that to sort of mend some of these bridges where people are talking to each other and for the good of the sport rather than the good of Bob Arum or the good of ESPN or, you know, the good of HBO or Showtime. Like, it's very frustrating that I don't see these strides made to try to, you know, do anything for the welfare of the sport. It's all self-interest.
Well, and what's really what's I think especially disappointing about all this, and I'm not going to pretend like I never, like I'm always an adult about this, and I'm never you know, childish, and I'm never like mocking or anything, because I often am. But at the same time, when Bob Arum and Top Rank secure a deal with HBO or with ESPN like this, and overall, I mean, I think that as a kind of a baseline, more boxing on television is good overall. But like you said, there's not much change as far as the monopolies or the factions and the ability for this fighter to be able to fight this other fighter, which is pretty absurd. It's almost as if it's a few different kinds of sports within one sport, where these guys aren't even allowed to fight, these guys aren't even allowed to fight. It's basically an updated form of segregation within the sport, which is just stupid.
It's very stupid, and it reminds me of like our childhood with wrestling, where you saw the professional wrestlers go from one organization to the other, you know, go from the WWF to the WCW to some barnyard version of, you know, Southern U.S. wrestling. And you're just like, wait a minute. Like, I'm not able to keep the storylines anymore. It's too weird. And I want to see this guy fighting this guy. You're absolutely right. The segregation is a very frustrating example of the futility of the sport. To if it wants to be accepted as a professional sport, it has to start acting more like it. And we need to see some kind of movement. Nobody's even really talking about it, about forming, I think, a union for the fighters to just get a basic standard of respect from the sport in terms of health care, a pension, like what every other professional athlete gets. No boxers get. And I think it is something that needs to be said, that there needs to be some protection for these guys risking their lives that's not over and above the other sports, but just meets that basic standard. And it's not there. And similarly, just that the sport that's put forward to fans on TV and pay-per-view and that kind of thing is commensurate with the other sports, where, you know, why has the UFC been able to gain such traction so quickly with an audience is because I think there is some nefarious business practices in terms of creating a monopoly, so fighters are not able to protect themselves the way Floyd has with a perfect record or who they fight. Dana White chastises fighters who don't fight in an exciting way. Certainly, you know, Floyd is not suffering from fighting fights that fans hated. He's able to make this fight with McGregor after the debacle of Pacquiao Mayweather. In the UFC, that would be very difficult because I'm sure Dana White would be punitive with fighters who would fight in a boring way that wasn't fan friendly because it hurts his brand. And, you know, I would like to see boxing just try to mend some fences and see if some cooperation were capable. It really doesn't have much of a history of cooperation. It's almost always the exception when promoters are able to work together. And after they do work together, like Pacquiao Mayweather or Lewis Tyson, you hear endless petty gossip about how horrible it was working with the other promoter, how much Arum hated Al Haymon. Dana White is going after Arum, and Arum is going after Dana White. It just seems so petty and childish. It's a really bad look.
It is really petty and childish too, and especially when it's the perception is that, like, you know, one deal is more legitimate than the other, and deal being like, you know, Premier Boxing Champions is less legitimate than the deal between ESPN and Top Rank. I mean, it's two sides of the same coin. There's no difference.
No.
So, I mean, it's another kind of example of this, and this gives me a decent little segue into the last fight here, the Naoya Inouye versus Antonio Nieves. In this feature here, or in this fight, the feature is obviously Inouye, who is a Japanese fighter making his American debut. And like I said, it gives me a segue because often the U.S., boxing in the U.S., like the American system is just not kind to certain fighters. And often, especially at lower weights, fighters have had to go elsewhere, or had to find a different place to go to be valued, basically. And that's what often happens at the lower weights when guys are able to secure belts and hold on to them for a long time. And that's why unification fights at lower weight classes are usually marveled at, because they don't happen that often. Guys get a belt, they hole up in some remote locale, and they just kind of fight there and say, all right, I'm defending it here against whomever, because now I'm, you know, that's where the money is for me. There's no point in going and fighting in this dude's backyard and that dude's backyard. And that's one thing that a handful of other flyweights have had to do toward Japan. Japan, for whatever reason, especially in recent years, has come to value fighters in those weight classes much more, and has also provided a platform for a number of smaller fighters. And it's not the first time. Even in the 1990s, a fighter named Yuri Arbachikov, he was actually a flyweight. He held the WBC flyweight title for a handful of years, and he became fairly popular in Japan despite being from Russia, basically because I just don't think there was much market for him to, you know, ply his trade where he was from, or, you know, anywhere close to where he was from. So he went to Russia instead and became fairly popular. And he's not the first fighter to have done that. For instance, Linares was also, you know, for a time training in Japan, and also has a number of Japanese team members and was sponsored by a number of Japanese brands, etc. So I don't want to go on and on about this, but the point is that Japan has a culture that values especially fighters of this size, and fighters who are skilled, and fighters who just, you know, bring the pain in a different way than the American boxing system does, or the American fight system, because it applies to martial arts too, or mixed martial arts. But Inouye is an undefeated He's 13-0, but he's undefeated, and his nickname is Monster because that's pretty much what he's looked like ever since he's entered the scene. I know a lot of people talk about Lomachenko, and that's totally fine. I like him too, and he's a marvel to watch, but Naoya Inoue does many of the same kinds of things in the ring that Lomachenko does. He is an absolute master of distance. He is just got every punch in the book. You know, he throws flawlessly, throws in combination, throws while moving, forwards, backwards, etc. I don't want to go on and on about the guy, but he's only 24, and he's accomplished quite a bit for only a 24-year-old. So it just seems like the sky's really the limit, and putting him on this card is just really a treat for a lot of hardcore boxing fans.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's not forget Piston Honda's contribution to Mike Tyson's Punch-Out as somebody that I was probably took me a month to beat him on my way into the heavyweight class of, I don't remember the fighters who came after Piston Honda, actually. Were you like an avid Mike Tyson's Punch-Out player?
Of course. Yeah, I was like, I was the perfect age for that because I remember getting Mike Tyson's Punch-Out when I was a little kid. Quick segue, my parents used to occasionally buy us Nintendo games if we had really good grades. And my brother always had really good grades. I always had like mediocre grades. But I remember one time I had good grades and I chose Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. And so, yeah, hell yeah. I loved Mike Tyson's Punch-Out.
Yeah. No, I think these are great fights. What do you think about the Joshua fight coming up? Like, it's Pulev is the opponent who's been announced. That's right, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I think that it's probably a more difficult fight than many people might realize because Pulev's he's a hard scrapper. He can punch. He's fairly tough, and he's kind of awkward and physical. So I think that it's the kind of fight where if Anthony Joshua comes in underestimating him, and he doesn't really seem like the kind of guy to underestimate many fighters, but if he does, he could be in trouble.
Sorry, I just couldn't hear you at the end there. Sorry, you just tuned out for a sec.
Oh, I was just saying that even though Anthony Joshua doesn't seem like the kind of fighter to take many people lightly, if he does, Pulev's he's a scrapper, and he could put him in trouble.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, and I think Joshua showed us in the Klitschko fight that he definitely is not he's not one of these guys that's invincible. He does have a jaw that's susceptible. If he gets hit cleanly, he can be dropped. So I think that adds an element to him that he's this huge guy with this huge power and charismatic and this massive future ahead of him. But at any moment, somebody could sort of step up who fights him aggressively and take him out. I don't know that Pulev is the guy to do it, but you're absolutely right. He's dangerous.
Yeah, it's a better fight, I think, than many people realize. But that's just kind of the way that it goes. And every so often, you know, especially at heavyweight, when it's filled with a number of fighters that many of us just haven't heard of, you know, the division has gotten better, but it's still not a very good division. So there could be some surprises. But that being said, I know you got to get going here. I know we had to cut the show a little short, so I figured I would give us an opportunity to phase out.
Yeah, next week we're going to have plenty to talk about to catch up with the longer show.
No question. There's going to be a whole shitload of stuff to talk about. And also, I didn't even get to talk about the whole cruiserweight thing, but we'll talk about it next week when we get the results. And anyway, everybody, thank you for listening in today. We very much appreciate it. We'll be back. Hopefully with a guest or two. And if you wouldn't mind, in the meantime, follow Bryn on Twitter at Brynicio, Brynicio. And me, Patrick Connor, at Patrick M. Connor. Go to Facebook, like KGB Radio on Facebook, Knuckles and Gloves page, etc. And on iTunes. Important, important, important. Go on to iTunes, rate us. Thank you so much, Bryn. Talk to you later, my friend.
Take care, man.
Later, everybody.